I'm reading Alice in Wonderland to my little girl at the moment, and the reason that's relevant is I've just come back from a long day in the city, in the office, drinks afterwards in the pub, somebody's leaving due, and now I'm headed to the Mad Hatter's tea party. But I don't know if I'm the Hatter or the Dormouse. Hey everybody, and welcome to the Sunny 16 podcast. My name is Aid, and you are listening to show 39. I am hoping that nobody from PwC hands me the wrong envelope today, because do you know what? Happening twice in 2 days, I just can't handle that. So instead, I'll say hi to Graham. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing very well, thank you, Aid. Very well. Aid, what's PwC?
PwC is PricewaterhouseCoopers. They are the people that do all the counting of all the things that go on behind the scenes in the Oscars. And they are at least partially responsible, in my never humble opinion, for the debacle that was Moonlight, La La Land, blah thing that happened last night before we record. It's a topical joke. It's an introduction to a podcast. You know, what you gonna do?
The problem with topical jokes is, yeah, you have to rely on the fact that I know nothing about anything. But
it's the Oscars.
I've heard of them. Yep, good. Okay, I'm gonna assume that something happened at the Oscars, and that was very good. Okay, good. I'm very well, thank you, Aid. How are you?
Well, a little bit discombobulated, but that's okay. We'll just get on with business as usual. We are a weekly podcast, and we will podcast weekly. I believe, though, Graham, you have a super special guest to introduce.
We do. It's a returning superstar to the show, and he joined us very kindly at short notice. We were discussing just before we came on, he is the broccoli-eating, Linux-using vegan warrior that is Eric, welcome back to the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me back. It's a twofer, I guess.
A twofer, yeah, exactly.
A twofer.
And we've got you nice and early in the day before your energy runs out from all the low-calorie broccoli that you're shoving down your gullet.
But, oh.
Okay, well, so we hit this threshold, you know, quicker than usual this week. Normally, Graham gets 15 minutes or so, sometimes 20 if he's on good behaviour, before I have to shut him down.
The thing is, we're recording later in the day this week because you were at a gig, an acoustic gig, before you came here. So we're running a bit late today. So I blame that on my punchiness, but I promise I'll behave for the rest of the show.
Okay. Folk music is definitely to blame.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's to blame for a lot of things, actually. But enough said of that. Listen, Eric, it's been a while since you've been on the show, but it's great to have you back. I understand you've been up to some publishing in the meantime.
Well, a bit of it, yeah. I decided on Friday that I wanted to do a zine, another zine, whether it's a second issue of the one that I did called A Conspiracy of Cartographers, or it's its own thing, I don't know yet. But I threw it together over the weekend, spent the weekend huddled over a computer, slaving away for hours on hours, and came up with something. We'll see what that something is.
Are you pleased with it?
I don't know.
I'm really interested in this because obviously we had Mike on last week, and we should right at the onset say thank you again very much to Mike for coming on. He was a goddamn delight, and yeah, it was a real treat getting to spend some time with Mike, and also big thank you to Mike for all the work that he did for us on Instagram as well, curating the feed and drumming up so many more followers than I have managed to do in the previous 6 months. So thanks for making me look terrible, Mike. But when we had Mike on last week, we were talking about the zines that he's stocking and how that's a new thing he's getting into, and it's something that a lot of people are doing. And I would love to learn more about the actual process of making a zine, what goes into it, because you've already made one, as you said. Yes. And you're now at the early stages of the second one. I suppose right. The first thing I want to know is, what with your first zine, did you start off with the idea, I want to make a zine, what can I make a zine about? Or did you go, this is a thing I want to share, how can I share it?
Well, I guess the zine thing for me started back in the 90s when I was a little punk rock kid. I would make zines and sell them at shows. And those were just, you know, political rants or stuff about things. And, you know, cut up, tape it out on the typewriter and then cut it up and paste it on a sheet of paper and then Xerox the hell out of them at Kinko's. But so that's what I knew as zines, what I guess Mike was calling fanzines last week. A photo zine was a totally different thing for me. It's more of a book than anything. I went through a long, decade-long poetry phase, and it feels so much more like doing a chapbook than doing a zine, though they're called photo zines, so that's what we call them. I don't know if that answers any question that you asked.
Well, I mean, it kind of does. Well, actually, no, it kind of didn't really. It actually failed to answer the question. The question was, did you have an idea of what the contents was going to be before you started making the zine? Or did you go, I want to make something?
The first zine?
Yes.
The first photo zine? No. I just decided to do one. I decided that it would be neat to do. I had a connection at Kinko's and decided to just throw 50 or so black and white pictures together of the favorites that I've taken and put them together in a little zine.
So there wasn't any, beyond the fact that obviously it's all your work and the things that you're interested in, which is, I think you have a fairly cohesive approach to your photography anyway. You're not like, say, for example, me, where the next picture could be literally anything. Your work is consistent. There wasn't a particular driven message that you were going for with this first piece of work.
No. It was just photos.
And has your approach changed for the second one that you're working on?
It has. Couple weeks ago, I was walking around Seattle, and I came across a sign that said, "Why is this happening?" It was a street sign somebody made. It's a viral marketing thing. That's not important. But while on the way to take a picture of that sign, I found another sign we have all over the city that says "No parking." Underneath it, there's its own sign that says "East of here," or "West," or "North," or whatever. And so they expect you to know what direction you're pointing in, which is funny. But the sign that just says "East of here," it's just its own sign. It really intrigued me, since we're on the West Coast. Everybody thinks of this.
Yeah, I understand. Quite a broad swath of no parking.
There isn't a definite end to this. But I mean, we're just thinking of the sign and thinking of Seattle, we're really living in a bubble. The whole western part of the state is really a bubble that we kind of don't think of anything on the other side of these big mountains in Washington State called the Cascades. And you go on the other side of them and it's basically a desert. It is actually a desert. And so people on the west think that the east is basically the Jutland Wastes. you don't go there.
Give it a couple more years, that might be depressingly accurate.
Yeah, well, in the east they don't go over here thinking that we're just all crazy hipsters.
But that seems actually startlingly more accurate than the east side, the west side of the east.
We're both correct. So for the second zine, I decided to title it or subtitle it "East of Here," and all of these pictures are of Eastern Washington.
So that's okay. So the East of Here is a fairly narrow definition of the East.
And well, yeah.
That sounds good. Here. So are you now going through all of your work? You've got a huge body of work. You take a lot of photographs. Is it difficult culling down to, because I guess, how many pictures did you have in your last zine and how many do you think you'll have in this one?
I think there were 45-ish in the last one, and there's about that much in this one. I think I have 42. And it depends if the printer can do like centerfolds, then I might have to figure something else out. But I think it's going to be 42, which is the answer to life, the universe, and everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Was it hard picking out 42 pictures from your fairly huge body of work?
No, I was in a crap mood when I was doing it. So I got to about 30 and I was like, all of this is shit. So I had to actually just kind of clear my head and go back to it going, oh, okay, I guess I'll let this one in. No, it was hard coming up with that many, more so than it was hard narrowing it down.
And are you looking, as you're going through your stuff and you're picking up, are you looking for ones that particularly sit with each other, or are you trying to get a real spread of a diversity in the look of them, or are you trying to sort of go, no, these are all grouped together and try and convey the, I don't know, the feeling that I want to get of East Washington?
I wanted to capture the entire feeling. Whether it's you're in a small town or on a back road or in, you know, parts of the small cities that are there. I wanted just to get a bit of everything.
So from your experience with the first scene, how effective, how useful do you think that zines or these little photo books are for photographers to get their stuff out there and to share it?
I have no idea. I've heard zero feedback on it, really. I've heard almost no feedback, which is probably not a good sign. And maybe you should stop me from doing it a second time, but whatever. I don't know. I've heard very little.
Well, I've just bought your first zine. I'm currently waiting for it to wing its way all the way from Seattle over to where I am. So I promise you that I will give you feedback.
I will give you feedback.
If I'm gonna say nice things, that makes the feedback invalid because it makes it not genuine. But I'm really
Unless
looking
it
forward to seeing it.
Genuine. You could keep all of it.
I'm sure I genuinely will.
You don't have to lie to me.
I know, but it just comes so naturally. But I'm really looking forward to seeing it. So you were saying that you've got a contact at Kenko's. So this, in some ways, this zine does still very much tie in with your punk rock day zines. You're still at Kenko's knocking these things out.
The old one did. Yeah, now I don't. He's moved to LA to do tattoos.
Maybe that's the way to share your photos. Get him to tattoo them on people.
Why not? There's really no reason not to.
There may be issues of them.
How'd you handle the intellectual property rights of that?
I would beg them to do it. That's pretty much the property rights would be freely given for that.
That does sound really cool, Eric. I'm glad you're getting around to doing another one, because I think as much as anything else, it sounds as though just the exercise of creating one is making you step back and look at your work in a probably far more critical way than you do normally, because most of your stuff you're sharing through Instagram and you share a lot through there, and I mean you don't overwhelm it, but you put quite a lot of stuff up there, and so go back and go, actually, out of this stuff, what stuff do I think is good enough to stick into this thing that I'm then going to stick on my store and hopefully people are going to want to buy it. Sounds like a really useful thing. I know you said you were frustrated going through it, you'd kind of ran out ones you like until you got yourself into a better frame of mind. Mm-hmm. Have you come away from this experience of going through them with thoughts that you're going to carry forward about how you shoot the stuff? Has it left you looking at stuff going, actually, I don't know, I'm doing a lot of one kind of thing, or if I do this, maybe this would be different or interesting? I don't know. Has it given you anything to work with going forwards?
This has a bit. I've noticed that I don't do foregrounds. And that was one of the frustrating things, is looking at all the photos and just thinking, they're not of anything. They're good backgrounds. There should be something that this isn't the photo. The photo, there should be something else right there in the photo, in the center, on the side, yeah, somewhere, and up front, and there's just not usually anything. So I tried to get the photos that were less wide.
Yeah.
I used to shoot everything wide. I used to only have wide angle lenses. And so more recently I'm shooting like with like 50 millimeters and whatever the Helios 44 is, and kind of feeling a lot more, things are a bit tighter. And I like that.
I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? Because for people who maybe didn't hear the episode where you first joined us, I cannot remember what episode number that was now. I don't know whether I can remember, but it was quite a while back now. But your work is of a lot of it's of buildings, old train yards, stuff like this. But the one thing that your one golden rule is that you don't want anything in your photographs that was it is younger than 40 years. Is that correct?
Yeah, give or take. It's obviously younger than 40 years.
Yeah. I mean, particularly pertaining to structure rather than people as such, but most of you tend to avoid having people in your pictures as well, don't you?
I tend to. Yeah. I a few more recent ones I've been able to sort of get people walking away and things like that.
That certainly makes it harder getting foreground stuff into picture when you're trying to work. I mean, I think having constraints is great. I think it drives the artistic process forward, but it makes it harder for sure.
It does. I had a kind of a revelation, and you know, I don't look at a lot of other photographers, but when I do, I always come off with a pretty big learning experience. There is a photographer named, Winston Link. He was a railroad photographer, and in all of his shots, he has something in the foreground. Even if the shot's about, you know, a train going by, there's something that's not a train in the foreground, whether it's a person or a sign or a tree or something. And it really drove the point home. Two points. One, that I need things in the foreground. And almost all of his work was at night, and he did a ton of stuff with lighting.
Yeah.
And I don't own a flash. Even so, it's kind of like, oh well.
Aid, you know. What do you feel about that?
I could send you one if you like. I've got tons.
I wouldn't know what to do with it. Most of my cameras don't even have a hot shoe.
Have you got a flashlight?
Like a flat, like what you guys call a torch?
No, you're a man who's been on adventure journeys on Vespers. You know, you must have something like that. Yeah. So that'll get you started. Point that. So go out around sunset. Point that at a sign, and there's your foreground with a nice sunset in the background.
Oh, perhaps.
Yeah, I'm actually just looking at some of Winston Link's pictures now, and I would highly recommend anybody listening to this podcast does the same, because they're great shots.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of those things when somebody says to you, oh, yeah, they're pictures of trains. A lot of them are pictures of trains. That is, one, it's true, but it's also like... It is a fraction of the story. His pictures are great. They're really interesting. And they just coincidentally, a lot of them seem to somehow have trains in them as well.
He was an interesting guy.
Yeah. The train is like a motif within the pictures. But the picture, great. I love his work. Absolutely love it. Never seen it before.
Oh, really? Oh, no. It's wonderful stuff. And he would spend hours setting up a shot, which is something I don't do ever. I never set up shots.
They have a very cinematic look to them, I suppose, with the lighting.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, that sounds great. Well, it sounds like maybe you need to invest in some sort of lighting.
Oh, I don't know what to do with it.
Well, I mean, you're allowed to learn things. That's okay.
I guess I could just spend hours and hours figuring it out, or days or weeks, I suppose. But I don't know. We'll see.
I tell you what, if you are minded to focus on finding some subjects for your foreground, actually starting carrying a flashlight around with you would be a really good way of doing it, because it would give you the focus to find that. And if you set yourself a task, right, this evening I'm going out and I'm not going to take any photos unless I'm pointing this light at something.
It's true. That sounds suspiciously like a project.
No, perish the thought. No, we don't do projects on this show. Every time we start projects, they just sort of disappear into the ether.
So.
That's not true.
I guess the other consideration I have is that I have bags of film, and there's slow ISO and fast. And my fast ISO film starts at 50 and goes to about 100. So
I suppose that's the other thing that people who have not heard the previous episode with you on should be aware of, is that you shoot with spectacularly expired film. Eric's Instagram handle is Load Film in Subdued Light, and you will see him using film that is significantly older than anybody on this podcast is.
Well, yeah. I've got some stuff from my favorite film is probably from 74, expired in 74. So that's older than me.
That's older than me by a year.
I'm saying nothing.
The old man of the show. Well, I will be watching your feed with interest, because I think your revelation about the foreground is a really, it's an interesting one, and I think it's a useful one to have kind of come to, because then when I went back and looked through, like, oh yeah, I see what you're talking about, and I will be looking to see if you do address this going forward, and I would love to see some night stuff, the places that you go to, some of the really cool opposite, they would look amazing with some night shots.
It's true, we're almost never there at night though.
But you're, again, this might just be one thing you have to change your approach. Embrace it, Eric. Embrace it.
I'm shooting large format now. Isn't that enough?
Oh, yes. You got a large format camera, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
And how's that going?
I shot four photos.
That's
four.
Good. I think you're one ahead of me at this point.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Nice. What do you have?
That's
the one you named after, what's his name?
I think your president.
Right. I don't know. Not mine. Maybe somebody else's.
Yeah, that's Ronald. So yes, I've got a lot. A Monroe. Remind me again what your new 4x5 is.
I have a Seneca Chautauqua.
You know what that is, don't you, Aiden?
I'm not going to attempt to say it. I'll tell you that.
Chautauqua is one of my favorite words. And it's,
is that a type of mushroom?
Oh, no, Chautauqua. I have no idea. I think it's, I don't know. I have no idea what it is. But it's a beautiful word. It could be French. Like my other favorite word, chaparral. Also French. Anyway, not the point. Anyway, it's from 1905.
Oh, crikey.
So,
is it a monorail camera as well?
No, it's this little slider, like a little collapsible folder.
Oh,
thing.
Cool. So it's more similar to something like the speed graphic kind of thing.
It's similar, but yeah, similar to something like that. You can't change out lenses or anything.
Yeah,
yeah, it's more like a Brownie.
Have you shared any of your work you've shot with it yet?
Yeah, three of the four.
Okay, how have you found the experience of shooting with it?
It is different. While I was taking those three photos with the large format, I took maybe 30-35s while I just wandered off and took photos of other things while setting up the shot.
Yeah.
It's just it's a long process. It's a weird process. The camera is so old that it uses a different f-stop numbering system.
Right.
So I'm converting stuff in my head, which means math and memory, which I've got zero talent in either. And then just working with like the sheet film and the holders and all of that. It's a rather than taking a photo, and it sounds so cheesy, it's like making a photo. You're really kind of building up to that kind of anticlimactic moment of flicking the shutter, because everything else that happens before that and even after that, that's, you're doing stuff, you're flipping things, you're pulling things out, you're putting a cape over your head, and you look like an old-timey photo guy, so that actually taking the picture is anticlimactic.
Yeah,
but everything around it is fascinating and interesting and new.
That's why I have so much awe and respect for the people out there who just as a matter of regular course, a shooting with large format, with 4x5 or even larger. I know I've mentioned him before on here, but people like David Weevil. I keep asking him to send us how to pronounce
Dave his Knievel.
Dave Knievel. Yeah, that's it. That's what
David Weevil also works.
David Weevil. up in Canada. I got tested it that way for you, Aid.
and for all the people in Canada.
I guess so. Who will take his 4x5 camera and just use it in the way that you or I would be shooting with 35mm or 120. And I know he's not the only one. I've seen... no, I can't remember the Instagram name, but there's somebody else. It's Chuck, I'm pretty sure is his name. But again, there's the same thing. Goes out and shoots loads of stuff. And having started down the large format route myself and having exactly the same experience that you are, Eric, of it just being such a process and an enjoyable process, but... Mm-hmm. I suppose it's one of those things that the more you do it, the more you get familiar with it and it becomes just more routine. But in the early stages, you're having to constantly think about everything that you're doing. Have I done this? Yeah. Have I done this in the right order? Because it would be so easy to make a mistake at any one of the numerous steps and just not realize until it's too late. But I'm really glad you're having fun with that. Actually, as we're on the subject of film, obviously going from large format down to the much smaller format, this seems like a good time for Aid to fill us in on a slight mistake he made about a conversation we had a couple of weeks ago, right, Aid?
Okay, I think it's time for us to take a break, and I will go and take a few deep breaths, and when we come back, I may or may not have a correction to publish. Do you know, it's not often I have to say this. Well, it's probably more often than I would like. But it turns out that I don't always get everything 100% correct in life. Now, you know, my kids are young enough that that doesn't matter too much. My wife occasionally likes to pick me up on it. But this week, the internet has helped me out. So thank you, internet. Okay, many of the listeners are probably streets ahead of me here, so I shall cut straight to the chase. Last week, we were talking about Ferrania and the original Kickstarter for Ferrania and the P30 film that's just in the process of being launched. And I made an error, as they say on the computer telly. I referred to the original Ferrania Kickstarter as being for black and white slide film, which of course is incorrect. Actually, I'd like to say thank you at this point to Jonas off of Twitter, who kindly copied Ferrania on his tweet to say, yeah, actually, Aide, you got it wrong. The original Kickstarter for Ferrania was, of course, for color slide film, and I should have known that, shouldn't I? Really, you know. But every now and again, I like to leave Graham a little in so he can get in a niggle and have a laugh at my expense, and I'd like to say thank you to Jonas and subsequently to Ferrania themselves for reaching out and saying, yeah, you know, you got that one wrong. So sorry, internet, sorry everybody, sorry Ferrania. It is of course a colour slide film that is the subject of the original Kickstarter, not a black and white one. So there you go, Graham, over to you, mate.
I just love this so much because out of the two of us, I am the one that throws out stuff left and right willy-nilly with nary a thought to whether it's factually accurate at all or to who I offend. And yet you're the one that not only got picked up by the internet, but got picked up by Ferrania going, you made a mistake there, boss.
But that's because you podcast in a post-truth world. I have a reputation on the internet for saying things that are largely correct.
You know, I think that's probably true. I think people just do not expect anything better from me. And I'm so happy to have achieved this level of, I don't know what the word would be, low expectation. That's what it is. People have an incredibly low expectation of what's going to come out of my mouth. And I rarely disappoint them. So
If only we knew of a country in this world where idiocy was rewarded.
I can't think of one. I just can't.
Your visa is in the post, mate.
Thank you.
No, but you've got to do a swap with Graham, no.
I'm not sure. Well, the weather in Seattle seems much the same as it is here, so I guess at least it'll be familiar. I'm. It's a good job you're better at apologising for these things than I am, Ed, because I'd have told them all where to go. I'd have shouted till I was blue in the face that no, they were all wrong and that they were making black and white slide film.
Okay, so moving swiftly on, actually, because the next thing in the show notes is another Kickstarter, or the next but one anyway. We might as well stick with Kickstarter for a few minutes. So this is something that caught my attention, and Graham, quite rightly, you've popped it up for our discussion today. Lab in a Box?
Yeah, I want to thank Spencer Beta very kindly shoved actually both of the things we're going to be talking about now under my nose. And yeah, this is... we're on a real run at the moment of interesting Kickstarters. The Lab in a Box is a Kickstarter for what it says here, the first multi-format daylight loading film tank. I mean, I'm not quite sure how it's the first multi-format daylight loading film tank, because I kind of feel like Patterson tanks are that. But this seems to be the easiest possible way for people to develop film at home. And I think maybe the reason that it's saying it's the daylight loading film tank is because this is one that you can actually load in the daylight without even needing a dark bag to go into. So I think that's what the big point of difference is. And it looks fantastic. This will work with both 120 or 35 millimeter film, although you do need a sort of separate module for it to do the 120 film as well. It's a neat little unit. And yeah, as I have not had a chance to really look into great depth as to how it works. But you put the film in, you start the end off and close it all up, and then just wind it on, and it does it all for you. It seems like a great solution for people who find it difficult to get film started on reels, for people who maybe don't have access to a dark room or who don't have a dark bag. We've discussed on many times how film photography is a resurgent hobby, and there are more and more people coming to it, and it's quite expensive getting film developed. And so this seems like a great way for people to get into home developing who haven't done so yet. What do you think about it, Eric? Because you are a home developer.
I'm looking at it now. I like it. I don't think it's something I would use. I do multiple roles, and this doesn't look like it can do multiple roles, which is fine. Most people don't. But it looks so simple. It looks kind of like the opposite of a bulk loader. You're taking film from the cassette onto a larger roll. I think it's great. I think it's great that you don't need a dark bag. I think anybody who is a little nervous about developing film for the first time, I think, thinking back to when I was doing it, this is something I probably would have looked into, simply because it's different, it's easy. I don't know how cheap it is, so that would probably be a deciding factor. But it looks pretty cool. I dig it.
Yeah, I mean, I think many years ago, there were other ideas along a similar idea made by maybe by Kodak, something like this. But these were old wooden boxes, which are long since defunct and don't work and stuff like this. There was nothing like this on the market. It is more expensive than simply buying a standard Patterson tank. But obviously, it's going to be a lot easier. And as you were saying, when I first got into it, I struggled like hell getting film loaded onto reels. There are still days now where I struggle like hell. We were talking before the podcast, and I talked about my technique with 35mm before, but it was a long, long time ago. So I'm going to share it again now, because it's the best technique in the world, and I do not understand why everybody isn't doing it. So 35mm film, I've got one of those Ilford film pullers, which you can use to just get the leader of the film back out if it's been wound completely into the cassette. So I get the leader back out, I trim the end, and then I just feed enough of the end of the film through the reel in daylight to get past the ball bearings, which is no more than you would expose when you were just loading the film into the camera anyway. Then I turn off the lights and wind it onto the reel. And you can never go wrong doing it like that. And you don't have to pull all the film off the reel and all that. And it makes it so easy to do it. That the Ilford film pull has been a transformative technology, and I would highly recommend it to anybody, particularly if you find getting 35mm onto reels. Because I remember in the days when I used to have to do it in a dark bag, and if you've got a 36 exposure roll of film and you pull all of that out in the dark bag, and then it gets a bit difficult and your hands are getting hot and sweaty and you've just got these coils and coils of film everywhere, it's a nightmare. Still haven't perfected getting 120 roll film onto a reel because you can't do any of that in daylight, but I'm getting better at it now. And as I mentioned fairly recently, the tip that one of my friends at the camera club suggested of just bending a millimeter or two of the end of the reel back over itself to create a little ridge, not a super sharp ridge because otherwise it splits the film, but just a little ridge makes that, keeps it a bit more rigid as you're trying to feed it through and makes it a bit easier. But I struggled like hell with 35mm and especially with 120. 120 for a long time. I dreaded developing it. And with this, you put the roll of film in the tank and you start threading onto reel a bit like you would when you're putting it into a camera, then close it all up, wind it on, and it just does it all for you. You know, you add the liquids and away you go. Great. Is this kind of thing appealing to you, Aid? Because you're the only one out of us that so far doesn't do developing.
I like the colours of it. It's a sort of fetching nice black and orange coloured box. It's, you know.
I mean, they've got a lovely video of some people just using it sat in their lounge. Is that not appealing to you?
Do you know what? It is. And, you know, this is, I'm looking at this, right? And the thing that's going through my head right now is that within just a few days, they've managed to get 3,000 backers. They've got €411,000 pledged, and they were only after 70,000. So they're already, what's that, nearly six times their goal. And they've got 28 days left to go. So these guys have obviously, you know, hit a rich vein of interest here. And as I look at it, I think, do you know, even I can understand this. As somebody who is way, way too lazy to do his own developing, I can look at these. I haven't watched the videos, but even just looking at the animated GIFs they've got on this, you can think, okay, yeah, I can see how that would work. That looks really, really easy. And if I was going to do it, I think this would be really interesting. I don't know whether there's anything like it similar, either as a bundle or something that's just is this just an expression in orange and black of good practice that everybody does at home anyway? I don't know. But actually, it looks like a fantastic product. But no, you know what? If I was going to do it, I'd probably have done it by now. I don't.
Yeah. No, I mean, to be totally fair to them, this is doing something new and unique, because the hardest part, I mean, as long as you get the chemicals right, and that's all pretty easy, especially if you're developing black and white, the hardest part and the stressful part of the process is getting the film onto the reel. Once you've done that, you just relax. Okay, great. Easy breezy, but they are removing the part which causes, as Michael Rassel on the FPP calls it, removes the film sweats, because it's done and you can just go. And I mean, and they do have on here, they've got various bundles, some with Kafnol, but also with things like the Monobath, which I am not familiar with at all. I don't know whether you've come across the Monobath, Eric.
No, I've never used a Monobath.
But I'm right in saying that this is a film developer that basically you just pretty much put your film in and it does everything, and you take it out and you don't need to worry about fixer. It does it. Is that right? Is it a sort of self-terminating and fixing thing?
I guess. I haven't used it. I don't know. It sounds too good to be true.
Yeah.
Or I don't know.
We don't know. We don't know.
I have no idea. Things you should know, I guess.
Yeah. Adel apologize next week. But anyway, what I think is particularly interesting about this.
If it's not my fault, I won't.
Listen, every show has to have an apologizer, and it's clearly not going to be me.
Well, that's true. Yes. Nobody's expecting you to apologize. So do you know what? For those, clearly, Graham, you were too lazy to scroll down the whole page of the Kickstarter, because if you scroll down far enough, there's a little section on Monopath, and I shall read it to you.
Oh, thank you.
It allows to develop the film quickly and easily with only one solution and in a few minutes, in a range of temperature between 18 and 24 degrees centigrade, or 64 to 75 Fahrenheit. This single solution develops and fixes at the same time.
Ah, so what you're saying is I was right. Cool. Thank you, Aid. God, so much scrolling to get back at the top of this page. What I think is particularly interesting about this, and I know we're covering ground we've spoken about a bit before, and you were just saying about how well-backed it's been. But it's really interesting because it is a product. Eric and I were talking about it earlier, and Eric was just saying that it's not a thing that he's probably going to want to pick up because he's quite comfortable with developing now, and he's used to it. And I've got my techniques which work for me. And so these people are almost certainly people who are going to be new to developing black and white film. And that's great, because it's one thing when we see a really well backed thing like the Jolly Look camera, because that's anyone can pick that up and it's a low barrier to entry and it's good fun. But it's that thing of it, it's a step further. This is people who are really getting into the hobby, and it's great to see. It's just another good sign that the film photography world is in good health at the moment. And I really like the product. I think it looks great. And I don't know if anybody listening to this has backed it. If you have, please let us know what it's like when you get it. I would be really interested to hear how well it works, because it looks like a really cracking piece of kit. Great if you're going away traveling or something like that. To be able to use it without a dart bag and stuff like that, that'd be great.
It would, as long as you're allowed to take your chemicals with you.
Yeah,
if you're flying, they don't tend to like you to take lots of large bottles of chemicals with you.
No, that's true. But with the monobath and stuff, it's if you're just doing going away camping.
So if you're not flying, I think you're absolutely right to taking this as something to travel. I mean, I can easily see this. You imagine you're going away on a summer holiday for a couple of weeks and you'd like to shoot, and because it's a relaxing thing you like to do, you'd like to develop some film while you're there. I think this would be an awesome little product for that, because it just seems to be able to do everything all in one box. And I think just looking at the videos, it seems to me that actually what they've sorted out for 120 film might be a little even more revolutionary. In the sense that you can put your 120 roll film with all the backing paper into a box, and then they've got a little hole on the back by the looks of it that allows you to pull the paper out whilst and at the same time the film winds properly onto the thingy inside the box to be developed. So I mean, if they've sorted out stuff like that, which could be really difficult, especially for people like me, I've no idea what I'm talking about really, but if I was to learn it, actually that looks like it could be really promising.
Yeah, no, it's great. Great, ingenious design, and great to see it doing so well. Awesome stuff.
Excellent indeed. Right, moving swiftly on to then, not another Kickstarter. This from our Love 'em or Hate 'em colleagues at Lomography. Graham, you've spotted a new product this week.
Again, this is thanks to Spencer. Not so much a new
product. Sorry, let me start that again. Spencer, you've spotted a new product this week and kindly informed Graham of it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, he's our resident news hound. I don't know what we'd do without him. Definitely not a new product. This is something that I think they've had in the vault for a while. This is colour negative film, not black and white slide film, to be perfectly clear.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's a newly available old stock. It's called the Lomography Color Negative F2/400 film. They've got some pictures of it on their site. It looks really very punchy colors, nice and contrasty. It's certainly very striking stuff. Looks really good. The reds in it look lovely. I will read very quickly what it says in the details. They bought the last ever jumbo roll of this film from some renowned Italian filmmakers. No idea who that might be from all the choices of renowned Italian filmmakers. Then they left the film to age like fine wine in oak casks in the Czech Republic. I have no idea why they did that. But
I'm not sure I've ever had Czech wine.
No. And yeah, so 7 years later, they go back and find that this film still produces refined colors with a beautifully unique tone. So there you go. It's they say something. It has a look similar to X-Pro, and I can certainly see that. You know, it is, the colors do seem very saturated. It looks very nice. It is limited quantities of this stuff because they've got one reel of stuff, and when it's gone, it's gone. They are taking pre-orders now. I think if you're interested in this, get on it quickly because I don't think it's going to stick around for very long. And it's saying that they're shipping from the USA and Asia. So, yeah, it looks like a nice, highly saturated color film. The colors do look quite distinct from a lot of the other color films that are available. So if you fancy something a bit different, it's not too expensive. I think you get a 10-pack for £50. And it looks like they do also sell it individually, I think. But, yeah, just interesting. A nice little one and done from Lomography there.
Yeah, it does look interesting, actually. They it looks like some really good saturation. I mean, you can't tell what's been done on it, of course, but looks like it's got some very good, strong blues. But slightly oddly, it also has some good, strong reds as well. So that's interesting. You can get a strong blue and a strong red out of the same film. Although, as I say, it's difficult to know how much processing has been done on those example also, shots.
The blues and the reds aren't in the same photos.
So you don't That's know what it would a good do. Point. Yeah.
Get mixed up there.
Good point.
This film's only 7 years old, Eric, so I'm guessing this is not going to be for you.
I think I have some.
Oh,
I
really?
I think I have some old Ferrania made stuff that was rebranded by the Seattle Filmworks. And it looks exactly the same as this. I'd be surprised if it wasn't this.
So, as you have first-hand experience, would you recommend this to people?
Yeah. Yeah, it's good stuff. It's really fun. It's really fun.
Cool. That's good to know. Well, yeah. This is nice. This is a real novelty for us to have somebody who actually knows, has relative experience on what we're talking about. That's good.
Yeah, I would assume that the reason it's been sitting in Italy and then the Czech Republic for so long is because Seattle Filmworks went out of business as they were using this stock of film. And it's just been sitting there waiting for somebody to use it. And here comes Lomography. I don't know why it was sitting for 7 years in the Czech Republic. I would assume customs and
Possibly. I'm also wondering why, if it's been sitting in the Czech Republic, they're shipping it from USA and Asia.
So many questions.
There's a lot of questions.
But having said that, I agree with Graham on the price, actually. £5 for a roll of 36 from Lomography is that's good pricing in the UK.
Yeah.
You wouldn't often get their film that cheaply. So,
no, this is very good pricing.
I wonder if any of it will get as far as hitting any of the actual stores or whether it will all get gobbled up by pre-orders. But we shall see. I suspect it may all go very quickly.
Well, you'll have to make a trip to London, Graham, and check in at Carnaby Street at the store there just to see what's up.
Yeah, or you could do that for me and just post me some. That might be.
What is your allergy to the big smoke, eh?
It's laziness. Always laziness.
All right. Fair enough. I can take that as an acceptable answer. Right. We are going to take a quick break again, and we're going to come back actually with some more serious news. So we do like to talk from time to time on this podcast about the work of individual photographers. And there's been a sad event this week that brought to our attention a photographer that we'd like to talk about and the work of that photographer. So Graham, you'd like to talk to us and all of us about Ren Hang.
Yeah, I'm sure anybody who's been keeping abreast of either the photography press or just the general press may well have seen this week that the Chinese photographer Ren Hang had died, aged only 29 years old. So incredibly sad to lose somebody at that age. He's a photographer who I was not familiar with at all before this happened. I'm quite glad, sounds terrible to say this, I'm glad that we get to talk about him. And the reason we get to talk about him on this podcast, apart from the fact that I think his work is very interesting, but it was a film shooter, entirely a film shooter. And he shot all of his work using a Minolta point and shoot camera because it did what he wanted. And so he just used that. And I find it really interesting. There's so many things that I think can be talked about with regards to himself and the work he was doing. And I know that I think all three of us were unfamiliar with his stuff before, despite the fact that he is somebody who had achieved global success, even if it seems like he wasn't particularly well received back home in China. There were issues there with censorship and so on. Because his work is... it's fairly graphic. It is almost entirely nudes, and they're pretty explicit nudes as well. And so, you're definitely not suitable for work. If you want to look into his work, it's definitely not suitable for work. But it's really interesting. I was looking at his webpage earlier. He's got a lot of his work on his webpage. He's also got his He wrote poetry on there, and he wrote at length about his struggle with depression. Now, it's all in Chinese, and reading it once Google Translate has mangled it makes it even more difficult to kind of get your head around. But he was clearly somebody who was struggling. Ren Hang was a gay man, and his photography was, to begin with, it was of friends. And I think in the later years, as he carried on, also fans of his work started taking part in his pictures as well. But it's really interesting work for a lot of reasons. The first one, I suppose, that is the most obvious one for us to talk about is because of what he was using to shoot it. When Eric and I were looking at it earlier, one of the comments you made, Eric, was that it was very flashy in the terms of there's a lot of flash. And
oh yeah,
that's because... the work tends to be split between photographs he was either taking in his high-rise apartment in China, indoors, or at night outside, because public nudity is very much illegal in China. So he was trying to do it under cover of darkness so as not to get caught and thrown in prison, which happened on a few occasions. And he was using a point-and-shoot camera with on-camera flash. So it gave his images a very... distinct. Well, it's a look we've all seen from any number of photo albums in the way. I mean, not the content, obviously. I mean, unless your photo albums are particularly bizarre. But Age, you're a lighting man more than myself or Eric. What do you feel about the look of the photos?
You know, what you see from a lighting point of view is very stark. And I think it's one of these things it gives you nowhere to hide. So given the impression I get from it is that, you know, I don't particularly understand the messages behind it, but the photos are very very stark in their lighting, and possibly that speaks to a strength of message. You know, I mean, clearly it may well be borne by technical limitations of the equipment he had available, but he's used it to make some very, very I can say use the word impressive images, but not impressive as in, oh, I'm impressed, but impressive as in they've made a very strong impression upon me. Mm-hmm. You know, there's nowhere to hide in looking at these photos. And, you know, it's, as you say, very graphic, a lot of very graphic nudity, but not in any way that I can recognise sexual nudity. Whilst I won't pretend to understand what the message is or should be, it definitely doesn't come across to me personally as being, you know, of a sexual nature.
No, and I agree entirely with you on this. It is. I think he's sort of said that he's not looking to actually share a message. He goes out there and he's trying to capture what he sees and how he wants to make things look, and that's just it. It's like, this is how I want this to look. And whilst the images are graphic and explicit, I completely agree with you that they are not really in any way sexual. In fact, they film almost the opposite of that, the starkness of the lighting and the way he positions the bodies of the models that he's using. I mean, some of the pictures are spectacular, where he's got people kind of behind one another but hidden, and so it looks like you've got people with multiple limbs and all sorts of crazy, strange things. They have a sort of very unreal feel to them. I you know, hesitate to use the word nightmarish, because that's not the word I'm looking for, but some of them feel like they would be perhaps not the best dream you ever had if you woke up from them. It was like, ah, they are. Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting work. Eric, when we were talking about it before, you first like, oh, I'm not really into it. And then there was a moment where you went, oh, wait, actually, I do really like his stuff.
Ooh. Yeah, the more I look at it, the more I get it. I really enjoy them. It's like a surreal anti-eroticism. It's good stuff.
Yeah, it's very strong. The way he puts pictures together, I mean, it's obviously a lot of people are going to just not like it. You know, the content is not going to be for everybody. And I mean, and I'm not sure whether I like it. I mean, I think it's really unique, and I'm hugely impressed by it, and I can absolutely see why he has been a worldwide success. I really don't know whether I like it or not, but it is good for what it is. I've seen people on comments pages drawing comparisons between his work and the work of other photographers who maybe use similar techniques or similar setups. So one name which we don't like to bring up too often on here, but is somebody like Terry Richards, who is the fairly notorious photographer who shoots... I mean, he's shot lots of celebrities, people like, what's that? God, complete brain fart. The Wrecking Ball woman.
Yes.
Miley Cyrus. Thank you. Old people brain fart. But his, you know, he's shot lots of nudes and lots of very provocative stuff. And his stuff is always very overtly sexual. And this is the opposite of that. And I've seen links to other people's work who are doing more similar stuff, but none of it really quite captures the same feel. And I read comments of people saying, well, you know, he's a one-trick pony and he's, you know, his lighting's terrible. But I anybody who has spent any time browsing through his work, for them to say that, I think really diminish somebody who clearly had an exceptional vision. And you know, he has created pictures that I have never seen before. And you know, even if some of them are, frankly, just slightly disturbing, that makes them all the more impressive. And yeah, it's I think it's well worth a look, and I think it's very sad, obviously, when anybody is. Well, I don't think any official news has come out, but I think the assumption, I think the widely reported news today, is almost certainly suicide. He's somebody who had suicidal thoughts and written about it, and so that seems like thing, and it's very sad, but an incredible talent. I tried to reach out to Tina Rowe, who's obviously expressed opinions when she was on the show about her feelings about nude photography, just to see what she felt about this work, because I would be really interested, because it feels a little bit unfortunate that you've got three straight white males commenting on how a gay Asian man portrayed nude women and nude men as well. But it's interesting work, and because it was shot on a 35mm camera, we get to talk about it. I wanted to just segue quickly from this, because obviously this is a work that has divided people, and in a fairly dissimilar way, really. But you got in touch with me a while back, Eric, because you were worried about exploitative photography of a different kind than what nude photography can be. You were concerned that your work was erring towards, I forget what the expression you used was.
I used, and it's not a term that really defines it, it's poverty porn.
So can you, as ill-fitting as that word may be, can you define what you mean by poverty porn?
Well, poverty porn generally would be like you watch a commercial for like Save African Children on TV or something, and they show pictures of children with flies on their face and distended stomachs, and they're trying to make you pity these other people so that you'll give money, and of course you don't really know where the money is going and all of that, so it's basically exploitation. Obviously that's not what I'm doing. Most people don't do that, but I do find myself in a lot of very poor regions of the US, and I do enjoy taking pictures of the way people live. And even though I tend to only shoot things that seem like they're old, the reason they seem like they're old is because they're still being used and people are still living there, even though I don't show them in my photos. So while I'm not exploiting people, since I don't photograph people, I am exploiting their lives in a lot of ways and their stuff, from whether it's their beat up old cars or the house they can't afford to fix. I'm not monetarily benefiting from it, but I'm aesthetically benefiting from it. And that having been poor, raised fairly poor, it doesn't sit well with me, and I don't know what to do about it.
It is. It's a really tricky one. I mean, Aid, I'm sure, like me, I think we have all seen more than our fair share of photographs of homeless people on the streets. That has unfortunately become a fairly ubiquitous cliche, and that, in some ways, that feels like the most direct
absolutely
analogy of the thing you're doing now. I mean, what's your thoughts on this, Aid?
It's a tricky one, or at the very least, I think there's multiple layers to it. I mean, I'm starting with something that I think we probably all agree on and is probably relatively straightforward. You know, the photographing in the street of homeless people, whether or not you offer them a couple of quid or a cup of tea or something like that, I think that is for me personally it in danger of being quite exploitative. I mean, you could argue that there's a documentary project on the go about the whole neighbourhood, which includes, you know, photographs of homeless people or something of that like and that ilk. And you'd say, actually, do you know what? Maybe that's not exploitative. Maybe that's some part of a bigger thing. But there are those photographers I've seen who not quite specialised, but who will quite regularly and quite readily, you know, go out and look to take photos of homeless people.
Yeah, that argument, I see where you're coming from, but that argument feels to me very much like the argument that Tina was saying about with nude photography, that this has been done. And I don't think at this point you can justify going, oh, I'm just, I want to document what things are like. It's like, no, people have already done this. At this point, you want to have photographs of homeless people because it's, I know it's edgy or whatever it may be. I think it's spectacularly hard to be able to take these photographs and say something new about the situation, because unless you're saying something new, I don't think you should be doing it.
No, I agree. And I think what I meant to say was that, you know, I can imagine that they might have a place in a documentary piece of work that is not just about homeless people. You know, you could document the homeless people alongside the rich people, alongside the normal people with shopkeepers and taxi drivers or whatever, and you're documenting a whole place, and right. and those happen to be some of the people that live in it. The reason I bring that up is that, you know, you start, I'm trying to start off possibly not the most coherent argument in the world, but I'm trying to start off from a position where we all think there's some danger of exploitation and work it into a place where, you know, actually you could see both sides of it, because if you focus just on the one thing, absolutely that could be exploitative. If not, maybe it's not. Maybe it is part of a bigger piece of work. And I think, you know, there is you have to look at it in it within that kind of context to, you know, to form an opinion. Do I think that, I don't know, let's get other end of the scale. I mean, I once toured California, and I know there are abandoned mining towns in California that are set up for tourists to take photographs of.
Sure, yeah.
Right, is that exploitative? Oh, they're exploiting us, actually, aren't they? Because they're charging you to go to their, to their abandoned town and take photographs. So, but are you, if you find yourself in a poor area and you are taking photographs of that, I think that there's got to be a question here about whether anybody is harmed. I think, that might not be the only question, but for me, I think, I've seen your work, Eric. You know, a representative selection of it, I guess. And did I feel that anybody was being exploited in that? Absolutely not. That is absolutely not what I got from it.
Mm-hmm. And also, I think, because we talked about this at the time, and I absolutely agree with Aid on this, but I think it goes even further than that. I think when we're taking pictures of things, there's probably a number of things which we could take photographs of which may have links with something which is, I don't know, perhaps less than ideal. But as well as whether anybody is being affected by it, I think also intent is very important. What is your intent when you take the picture? And what are people taking away from that picture? So I think most people, when they, because of what you're looking to show in your pictures, your pictures are not looking to show poverty, despite the fact that, as you said, they may well be in very poor areas. Your pictures are looking to show age, and that comes through. And so I do not think that there is a conscious link between that and poverty, and I do not think that is your intent either. I don't feel that there's an underlying message that you're trying to say, and even if I think if you have a message that you're trying to get across and it's well put together, I mean, there are plenty of instances, you know, I'm sure we can all think of, I mean, like the classic is Diane Arbus, her photographs of the Depression era. That's right, isn't it? I am getting the right photographer here.
I think so. Yeah, I think of Walker Evans in the Depression era. But yeah. I think she, yeah.
So, do you mean Dorothea Lange?
Yes, thank you. That's okay. Exactly who I mean. Yeah, thanks. Well, you know, it started with a D. But, you know, these are people who are taking films to shots to make people aware of situations. Sure. It doesn't have to be exploitative. I think it depends very much on your intent when you're taking a photograph, as well as because I think just nobody being harmed probably isn't enough of a thing. Because when you're taking a photograph, I mean, no one's ever really, unless you're very unlucky, going to be hurt by a photograph being taken. But I think the photographer's intent and the way that it's put forward is more important. And I think if you're trying to document something that it is showing people who are vulnerable, whether it's through poverty or health or circumstance or whatever it may be, I think you do have to be very careful with it. But at the same time, I do still feel like maybe you're a little oversensitive on this one.
I'm not looking for absolution. I just think it's something that I need to keep. And I think it's something everybody should keep in mind. But me specifically, I think I really want to make sure that I'm not personally, you know, like when you look at any kind of exploitation, you're getting some sort of joy, I guess, or titillation or something from whatever it is that you're exploiting. And I don't, you know, I know that when I you know, drive into like a shitty Kansas town, and I like, oh my God, there's so many things I can take photos of here. And when I step back from that and think, well, yeah, but this town is beat for a reason. You know, there are people still here. This isn't a ghost town. People live here. I'm taking pictures of their lives. I wasn't invited in here, and yet it's, you know, legal to do. But it's a fine line. And I think attitude certainly has a lot to do with it. You know, I don't want to see them as the other. And that's a problem we have in America, I'm sure a lot of places, but we love defining us and then the other. And I really don't want to do that, especially considering my background.
So you know, can I ask, I mean, when you are going to these places, and obviously you're at the moment, what you're doing is capturing small snippets of it, and so you're showing them, and so, you know, so you're not really conveying that message. I mean, do you feel like maybe you ought to be going, actually, no, this is what this is like. This is in a poor area, and this is what these people's, you know, do you think it would be fairer to give a more complete picture?
I don't know, because then I would be assuming their voice.
Well, I suppose it's very difficult to take photos without giving some editorial slant, but at the moment, you arguably you're cutting them out of history in a way by kind of selectively going, you know, shooting around the harsher realities of the areas.
Well, in a way, I'm cutting them out. Personally, I'm cutting them out completely. There are no people in my photos.
Yes.
So, you know, I'm left with buildings and trucks, and in places that look very much like where I grew up. And I don't know, maybe that's a connection I should explore. I guess I just don't know where to go with it, and I don't know how I ended up here. And you know, I didn't think about it too much last year on the trip I did into the Southwest, but the trip before that, which was to Kansas and Iowa, wonderful vacation spots if anybody's interested. Really, they are. They're great places to wander around. But every time we would go into a town, I would have that feeling of half joy And then, yeah, walking around and talking to some of the people and going into shops and things, just like, wow, this place is rough. This is a rough place. And I'm not like a Walker Evans being hired by the federal government to go take pictures of Depression era. That's not my job. Neither is it my job to give these people a voice. You know, I don't have that. That's not my responsibility. And that's, I can't do that. I don't know what their voice is. But also I don't want to see them as the other. So it's a really weird line that you almost have to default to, I don't know, man, I'm just taking pictures.
Yeah.
And kind of live with that.
It's a tough one. It is a tough one. I genuinely wonder whether your discomfort with the photo or with the, you know, with the photos you're taking is the fact that is actually about the things that you aren't taking. I wonder whether it's because you feel that maybe you're just taking what you want from it and not, you know, a bit like, oh, I these are the bits that I like, I'll have that, but the rest of it I'm not going to show because it doesn't, I don't feel I can show that. I don't know. It's
that's photography.
Yep, that's true.
That's photography. That's just part of the medium. You know, if I was, I guess the only thing that's not that would be like driving the Google car. So, that's right. I mean,
they take photographs. That's true.
Yeah, I mean that's I'm not the Google car, so yeah, I'm gonna select things that I want to photograph.
But that's okay.
It is. It is okay. But I guess I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be
I think like, your respect for these people and the places that they live is above and beyond what many people have, and I think that's a really, really good thing. I think respect and understanding the impact you might be having on people, either on purpose or accidentally, is a strong place to be. I suspect I side a little bit with Graham on this, in that I think you're probably in a really safe zone for most people, and you probably don't have much to worry about.
Well, it's good. I guess it's just something that. Maybe we should all be mindful of, and I'm probably taking it too far, like I do with many things.
You are the world's conscience, Eric.
No, I'm barely my own.
Do you know what? If more people were as respectful, we probably would be in a better place.
And would probably take very few photographs at all, I suspect.
Not of people, anyway.
Yeah, I'm not sure how. What's that American clothing chain that famously uses suggestive photographs of teenagers?
American Apparel.
Yeah, them. I doubt they'd be taking many photographs.
Well, no, they would bring their models to places like this, and that would be actual poverty porn.
Yes, that would be a fine example. Okay, so there you go. So there is a reasonably unambiguous example of what you're worried about.
And so since I don't shoot subjects, I guess I'm scot-free here.
Yes. If anything, you may be guilty. You may be guilty of exploiting some signs.
Maybe. Perhaps.
But they're probably okay, unless they've got a union. Have you
busted where I go. We don't have unions anymore.
Maybe so you'll probably be okay then.
Probably. I guess I'm keeping this in mind. We're heading back to Kansas and Iowa this year, and it's just something that I've been thinking a lot about, and trying to maybe shoot differently because of that. Because why not give myself another hurdle?
Well, do you know what? What you could do is you could say, okay, when I get to a place, I'm going to go into the local diner and I'm going to talk to the people there about the photography I take and see what they think of it.
The stiffening silence says it all. Human contact? Oh, hang on a second.
I don't know if I do that.
Well, it would provide you with some clarity, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So I'm in the middle of a scary photography project at the moment, as you know, which is about taking photographs of strangers, my chain reaction project, of which there is little news in the month of February, but it's a very short month. And on the run up to Christmas, I was genuinely quite worried about this project. And so far, I found that everybody involved in it has been absolutely delightful, and I've already met two or three people that I wouldn't have had the chance to meet otherwise, and had a fantastic time doing it too.
It's good.
I think you're gonna have to get us out of here, because I think you're making Eric upset with the prospect of having to talk to people whilst he's taking photographs.
Do I have to talk to people?
Well, you're on a podcast, Eric. This is what we do on the podcast. I mean, it's a bit easier for us, right? Because we forced ourselves upon people for 40 weeks nearly now. So, you know, we're getting a little bit more comfortable with it than we were maybe in the middle of last year. But no, okay. So, we're not going to push you on this.
It is genuinely something I need to work on.
It's an idea.
Talking to people.
It's an idea.
It's a good idea. It's a good idea. And I think that would... if you don't want to see people as the other, you do need to open a dialogue with them. And so that's something that should be done, and not just for photography sake, but for, you know, we're all humans, and knowing other humans is actually a good thing. You know, and maybe the messed up state of our nation right now would be a little different if we did that. So, yeah, I think I kind of, it's my freaking patriotic duty to talk to people.
I hadn't meant to go that far, to be fair.
I'll back it up a bit.
but you know, if that's what makes it work for you, if that's okay.
And at the end of the day, Eric, I mean, I know what you're saying, but you can't speak with their voice, but you can speak with your voice, and it's in particular, if your background is actually resonating with some of the stuff you're seeing, yeah, you have something to say about it, and. Yeah. You should feel confident sharing that. I sometimes feel like a lot of your work, you try and avoid putting yourself in as much as you avoid putting in other human beings. And maybe these niggling things is your brain going, I don't know, maybe there's something I actually want to say with this beyond just documenting these places. So you explore it.
True. Yeah, I put more selfies than.
Yeah, that's exactly what I meant. More selfies, yeah.
Awesome, I can do that.
You wanted some foreground subjects.
Okay, so without entirely diluting the impact of Eric's photography, should we try and wrap up the show?
Good plan.
Okay, listen, Eric, it's been fantastic to have you on the show again.
Absolutely.
Would you like to point any of our listeners in the direction of your work?
Sure. I am LoadFilm in Subdued Light on Instagram. My photography blog is at littleblackstar.com. And on the Flickas, I am looking it up right now because I do not remember. I believe I am probably Load Film and Subdued Light or Little Black Star or a bit of both, or under my actual name of Eric Swanger. So I think looking up the Load Film in Subdued Light on Flickr will get you there.
That'd be a good start, wouldn't you? And what if I wanted to buy a T-shirt with a picture of Yoda that says Yoda was vegan? Where would I get one of those?
You'd have to go to Etsy and search.
Sit properly.
Sit properly, or just search Yoda was vegan on Etsy. And I'm feeling I'm the only thing that comes up.
it's a new one on me, I have to say. You're probably right, though. I'm going to ask my boy tomorrow morning. He is seven, and if anybody would know whether Yoda was a vegan or not, it would be Patrick.
According to the old canon that's been since made legends, Yoda was vegan. I don't know what they've done with that in the new canon, though.
Difficult to say when all of those dollars are involved. Anyway.
It's true.
All right. Yeah, excellent. That's brilliant. So everybody, as I do sometimes at this time in the show, I demand that you all go and look at Eric's stuff. And probably you should go buy his T-shirts as well.
Yes, please.
Right, so this is the end of the show. You can get in touch with us, of course, at the Sunny 16 podcast in any number of delightful internet-driven ways. You could contact us at Sunny 16 podcast on the Instagram, Twitter, Flickr group, or even sunny16podcast@gmail.com. Graham, I'm guessing we haven't had any emails for a while.
No, we haven't. I just want to use this opportunity because thanks to all of Mike's sterling work last week, I know that there are more people tuning in, checking us out this week. So anybody who's picked us up in the last couple of weeks, thank you very much. And I hope you stick with us and, you know, and go back and have a listen to some of the other guests we've had in the past. We've had some great people joining us. Find that Eric's previous episode and then all the things we talked about will make more sense then. But yeah. A big welcome to all the new listeners, thanks to Mike's hard work.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you very much, Mike. It's the first time we've had videos on our Instagram account. And, you know,
it's the first time we've had Fleetwood Mac on our Instagram account.
Okay. All right. So other thanks that we owe thanks to Chris at pixelatedphotographer.com for hosting and supporting the podcast. Bill, no doubt in the background, is still beavering away on the show notes. I'm not sure if Graham has published any, though. Have you done that yet?
Moving swiftly on.
Where do you publish your show notes?
I said moving swiftly on.
Okay, listeners, Graham hereby promises that if he doesn't publish some show notes in the next week, on next week's episode, he will make an apology.
Ooh.
Okay, and of course, as we do every week, we say thank you to Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com. Who is an extraordinarily prolific creator of incidental music. Go lose yourself at Incompetech, as we regularly do. Which I think is absolutely everything. So we will speak to you next week. Hopefully I haven't made so many gaffes this week that I need to publish corrections and apologies. Hopefully Graham won't back himself into a corner and be required to apologise next week.
Well, I won't do it. We all know I won't do it.
Okay, well, folks, you heard it here first. Tune in next week. Thank you and goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
So, Eric, when you're just listening to these, right, do they come across as reasonably coherent? Or is there any inkling from the finished product of the nonsense that goes on in the manufacturing?
They really do sound, they do sound well edited.
Oh,
that's a backhanded compliment if ever I heard one.
Backhanded, yeah.